Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. You can watch today's program by going to the Ustream channel and just searching for Gary Null. Also, we have people who are out and about, traveling, working in taxi cabs, and they can't be by a computer or by a land-based radio station necessarily, but they can always listen over the telephone, and some have created very ingenious listening devices. I was in a cab recently, and they had hooked up a speaker in the front and back seat where they were playing the program. Hadn't heard that before. So you can listen live Monday to Friday, noon to 1, Eastern Standard Time, by simply calling a phone number if you can't listen on any other device. Let me give you that number to call in on. If you ever don't hear me on your station, you can call 712-775-6850, 712-775-6850. Today, we're going to talk about the secret to younger brain may lie in what? Well, University of Japan, I have an answer for you. And the Mediterranean diet can keep your mind healthier in old age. Columbia University has got something to say about that. And a high-fat diet causes changes in the brain that lead to anxiety and depression. University of Paris, got that. Harvard scientists warn people to stop drinking low-fat milk. Why are they doing that? Well, a Harvard scientist will tell you. And a lot more on health and healing. Today I'm going to address two issues in depth. One is, are people stupid, many, by intent, where they just choose ignorance, or they just don't get it? They can't get it. I'm going to explore this, and in a proper context, but I'm also going to play you a clip where people from all walks of life in all settings, near college campuses, on the beach, and people at all economic strata were just asked simple questions. I think you'll be surprised by how they answered. Then I will do an in-depth commentary on that. Because we're not all going to get it, and we're not all going to be healthy. Why? Why shouldn't we all be happy and healthy and get it? Meaning life. Then my guest in the second part of our program is Professor James Kilgore from Urbana, Illinois, and he is a popular professor and research scholar at the Center for African Studies, University of Illinois, and we're going to talk about the urgent need for an overhaul and reform of mass incarceration system and its relationship to the nation's failing to address the social needs of so many of its population. Also today, I'm going to share three different reports on how we are in the midst of a collapse, but we're like the boiling frog. If you put the frog in the water at a low temperature, you know, and you change it slightly, it adapts until it boils. So we are in the midst of going from a recession into a depression. And yet, depending upon where you live, in the circumstances of your existence and the context, you may not see any of it. But I've just been all over the United States, and I'm seeing it all. And I'm simply telling you that we are headed for a massive collapse of many of our systems. The real estate system is going to collapse. The commercial real estate is going to collapse. The equity partnerships are going to collapse. The entire equity market in Wall Street will collapse. The bond market is going to crash. And I wished I were wrong, but once I give you the indicators, not theory, but show you the numbers of the hundreds of billions of dollars the different groups have in debt, that everyone is buying things on debt, all to have their stuff. Well, George Carlin will be here later in an audio clip talking about that stuff. So as you see, we have a lot to share. Oh, and by the way, Iceland just jailed dozens of corrupt banksters for a total of 74 years. How many did we bail? Let me think. How about zero? None of our corrupt bankers had to go to jail. They got raises. And instead of being too big to fail and now too big to jail, they've grown in size by 40%. I thought the Dodd-Frank Amendment bill was supposed to keep that from happening. Just the opposite. I'll tell you about how corrupt that Dodd-Frank Amendment was. Now, we all want to have younger brains. How do we do that? Well, according to the University of Japan, quote, it is widely recognized that our physical fitness is reflected in our mental fitness, especially as we get older. How does being physically fit affect our aging brains? Neuroimaging studies in which the activity of different parts of the brain can be visualized have provided some clues. Until now, however, no study has directly linked brain activation with both mental and physical performance. As reported in the latest volume of the journal Neuroimage, an exciting new study led by Dr. Soi at the University of Japan and his colleagues show for the first time the direct relationship between brain activity, brain function, and physical fitness. So, in fact, it says, quote, they found that the fitter men perform better mentally than the less fit men using parts of their brains in the same way as in their youth. Now, we all know as we age, and we use different parts of our brain compared to our younger selves. For example, when we're young, we mainly use the left side of our prefrontal cortex for mental tasks involving short-term memory and understanding the meaning of words and the ability to recognize previously encountered events and objects and people. When older, we tend to use the equivalent parts of our brain on the right side for these tasks. And there's a difference in how this allows function, memory, intelligence, language, and vision. So here is what you got to understand. Every time you exercise, especially aerobically, biking, jogging, power walking, swimming, you are creating a more dynamic movement in the brain of its chemicals. In effect, you're turning on the ignition and allowing that engine to start to roar. The more challenging the tasks intellectually, creatively, the younger your brain gets. So the mere act of exercise keeps your brain younger, but then learning a new word and how it can be used, learning a language and applying it, building something that you had no experience in but you learned from scratch, starting over, learning from the bottom of a learning curve to the top, all challenge your brain. As a result, your brain has to reconfigure its own chemistry and how these electrons, neutrons, and protons all interrelate. So, if you want to be healthier, wiser, more intellectually active, you have to think, challenge. Don't be passive. Reading, passive. Watching movies, passive. Watching concerts, passive. Watching television, passive. On a computer, passive. Cell phones, passive. You got to stop being a spectator. Get into life. And the older you are, the more active you should be, the more things you should start doing. Just the opposite of how the paradigm told us we should react. From Columbia University, here's an interesting study that was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology. Quote, in news that sounds a bit like it came straight from a sci-fi thriller, researchers say that eating too much meat might shrink your brain. Well, that's good. On the flip side, however, eating healthy foods from the so-called Mediterranean diet may help your brain stay in good shape as you get older. Researchers said people who ate the vegetables and the fruits and the grains and olive oil and fish had a larger brain volume than the similar group who didn't follow a Mediterranean diet. Quote, it was encouraging to see that The more you adhere to this Mediterranean diet, the more protection you get against brain atrophy, which is shrinkage. And that's according to the professor of neuropsychology at Columbia University. So that is the diet that we have been promoting for decades. Now, you'll see why this is important when you hear an audio clip in a few minutes about how Americans are stupid. Not all Americans, of course, but how a pretty large group are. I mean, these are the... I'll hold my thoughts until later on that. But what they're eating could be one part of that. Now, if you want to help protect yourself, spicy foods. This is the latest study on this, and here's what it shows. Quote, hot peppers. In fact, the hottest pepper known in the world is the ghost pepper. With a score of 1 million Scoville heat units, it will scorch the mouth of any hot pepper connoisseur. Amazingly, the heat is where the health benefits come from, particularly in the skin that surrounds the seeds. Some drugs can now be delivered through this same system. However, nanotechnology carries risks, the primary one being lung damage. Studies have shown that most nanoparticles migrate to the lungs. Other organs are susceptible to damage as well. And instead of inducing programmed cell death, nanoparticles induce autophagy, a process that degrades and damages materials in the cells. And then it goes on to talk about how when you're eating peppers by themselves, not as a part of a hot medicine, the body is actually able to do the following: lower blood pressure, help heal ulcers, help kill bacteria that are harmful but not good bacteria, help kill viruses. Great if you have a cold or flu coming on. Great if you have inflammation. It turns off inflammation in the brain, turns off inflammation in the joints, turns off inflammation in the eyes, protects you from glaucoma, cataracts, and macular degeneration. Turns off inflammation in the lungs, helping you cope with some of the congestive pulmonary conditions and asthma, and helps you with cancer. So, you don't want to start off with a high heat index. Start off with a Jamaican curry. That's a mild curry, but very beneficial. Start off just by sprinkling some of it on, let's say, some brown rice. And then you can see how much you can handle. Recently, I had a wonderful evening with members of our audience who came together just to socialize at dinner and then go to a movie. And didn't end up going to the movie because so much time was taken at dinner, several hours. It was just, to me, it was just a pleasure seeing health-minded people, all professionals in their fields, from musicians to writers, come together and just share stories about life. It was very optimistic, very positive, and they had a great meal. But then I watched them, and I put some, how much pepper I put on, and they're looking at this, and I see, you think it's a lot? Too much? That's a lot. I said, well, how much can you take? They start putting some pepper on them. And there's a certain point where you say, that's enough. But then remember, the more hot pepper you use, the healthier you become. I'm not talking about using a ghost pepper. I'm not talking about using the high heat index jalapeno peppers. But you can use chili pepper. And especially if you're diabetic or have high blood pressure, or if you have a heart condition, it can help save your life, especially if you take it before you go to bed at night. But take it with some aloe vera juice. Now, something good that can kill ovarian cancer cells, and speaking of ovarian cancer, I just spoke with you, Therese Lead, yesterday, and for those of you in this audience who are coming on Everyday New, Therese was a major voice for progressives on WBAI in New York for 21 years. She had a two-hour afternoon program called Talkback. And she's had a program for the last 6 years on the Progressive Radio Network following my program. Well, she ended up with terminal cancer. She was given a death sentence, very short time to live. And the primary metastasis was out of the uterus, and which kills a lot of women each year. And it metastasized to the lung, and she had stage 4B lung cancer, on addition to the other cancers in her body that also were deadly. Well, the good news was that from her first MRI and her most recent and her conversation with the doctor this week, the entire cancer in the uterus is now contained, encapsulated. All of the metastasis is gone. Gone. Doesn't exist. So, and here's the funny part of this. The doctors are praising and high-fiving the fact that it was the chemotherapy. Good. Let them think that. Because she has all the chemotherapy jars unopened in a bag from the pharmacy, unopened with a receipt. So every time the doctor says, "How's that drug doing?" she just smiles. So she's smiling, saying, "Doctor, you're just too dumb to know the answer." But very shortly, I intend to approach that doctor with a camera and ask him how she's doing. And in the next 3 or 4 months, and if he says, "Well, the cancer's gone," I'm going to say, "And what caused that?" And I want him to brag about the chemotherapy. Then I'm going to ask her to hand him all the chemotherapy. It was never used. She did it through lifestyle and behavior modification. Then we'll see what that's about, and I'll play the audio clip of that on the air. So we have something else that can kill ovarian cancer cells, frankincense. That's right. So the question is, could an ancient aromatic resin really hold the key to stopping the spread of ovarian and other cancers? Scientific research suggests that very well may be the case for frankincense. Franken, F-A-F-R-A-N-K-I-N, sense, C-E-N-S-E. A plant resin derived from the tree called Boswellia, B-O-S-W-E-L-L-I-A, which is grown in parts of Arabia and Africa. Now, frankincense has been used for a long time, mainly because it's anti-inflammatory. It's used in alleviating symptoms such as asthma, gastroenteritis, skin disorders. And now it can show its ability to stop ovarian cancer from spreading and even induce cancer cells to close down. So it's got a long history. Frankincense is probably best known as one of the three gifts, along with gold and myrrh, brought by the wise men at the birth of Christ. And historical records show that frankincense was produced in the Dhofar region as far back as 7,000 B.C. in Wadi Dakhil, a valley set inland from the major city of in that area of the world. So, look now if you have cancer, ovarian cancer, to frankincense. All right? And there's a lot of good science behind it. There is a immunologist, a Dr. Suhail, wanted to explore the cancer-stopping properties of frankincense further. And it's known that cancer starts at the cellular level when the DNA code within a cell's nucleus becomes corrupt. But scientists have observed frankincense providing a type of reset function, communicating the correct DNA codes to the cell that allow for a type of do-over. And that's where this original research came from. So that's good. And finally, a high-fat diet can cause changes in the brain that lead to anxiety and depression. This is from the University of Paris in France. Quote, "A new study in mice reveals that increased body fat and high blood sugar as a result of consuming a high-fat diet may cause anxiety and depression symptoms and measurable changes in the brain." Well, that's the American diet. This was published in the British Journal of Pharmacology. So, give up those high-fat and high-sugar diets. And also, from the University of Pennsylvania, stressed dads affect offspring brain development through sperm microDNA. Now, this is part of that epigenetics that we've been talking about. I'll quote this verbatim. Quote, "University of Pennsylvania researchers have shown that the molecular level how experiencing stress changes a male mouse's sperm in such a way that it affects his offspring's response to stress. The change is imparted epigenetically or through a means other than the DNA code by molecule called microRNAs." So, one more verification of epigenetics. And what do I mean by that? I mean that whatever happens in the environment you're in, epa means larger over genetics yourself. So let's say you grew up in a family and you may not have been appreciated or loved in a way that was meaningful. They may have thought they were loving you, but maybe it wasn't the right way. And so you couldn't experience that at an intellectual level, so you experience it at the emoting level. Your cells absorb the energy, negative or positive, from the people in your environment. And then later in life, you responded to that as if it were real in the moment you're in. Hence, someone today could get really angry, and you think, what are you getting angry about? What are you getting upset about? What did I say? What did I do? In point of fact, it's nothing that you said or did that caused someone to be angry, more often than not, for an epigenetic response, I'm saying. It's something that happened when they were young, and now they automatically, without any conscious control, they go to the reset, reload, and then act. And the cell responds and sends a message to the brain responds, and they say something and do something that is completely against common sense, reason, logic, or even their own well-being. How many times have people self-sabotaged? Almost all that is subconscious, and almost all that is epigenetics. Now the question is, can we change that? I will deal with that on an upcoming one-hour special with Bruce Lipton and four other epigeneticists to show you, yes, we can change. That's an upcoming program. Oh, I've got to mention this from our public health segment. This is good news. From Daniel Barker from Natural News, quote, the soda industry is dying. Hooray. Send flowers. Why don't we send some poison ivy? As Americans seek healthy beverages that don't cause diabetes and obesity, Americans are finally waking up to the fact that drinking soda is an unhealthy practice. You think? How could it possibly be unhealthy? It only has sugar, artificial coloring agents, cancer-causing agents, carbonation. You think? Sales of sugary, carbonated drinks have fallen dramatically in recent years, sending the soda industry into a panic. Give them each. Everyone who works for the soda industry, give them each 3,000 milligrams of a Prozac and Paxil and Valium today. It may be bad news for big soda, but it's good news for the rest of the population. Sodas have been one of the main contributors to obesity among Americans and to disease-related to unhealthy diets such as diabetes. Good. See, there is good news. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I remember my first love affair. Somehow or another, the whole darn thing went wrong. But my mama had some great advice, so I thought I'd put it in the words of this song. I can still hear her saying, boy,
boy, boy,
oh, I see you sitting out there all alone, crying your eyes out, cause the woman that you love is gone. Oh, there's gonna be a whole lot of trouble in your life. So listen to me, get up off your knees, cause only the strong survive. That's what she said, only the strong survive. Only the strong survive. Yeah, you gotta be strong. You better hold on. Don't go around.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. In about 10 minutes, we're going to talk with Professor James Kilgore about the urgent need for an overhaul and reform of mass incarceration system and its relationship to the nation's failure to address the social needs of its population. A couple program announcements, then I'm going to play a clip, and then I'm going to respond to it. First and foremost, I'm going to be hiring some people. I'm going to hire a research editor, someone who's very good at doing research and then editing the material they research, because we're working on a huge project right now. And the project is going to take us quite a long time, but my intent is to have it ready to share at a press conference in Washington and New York in the same day, one in the afternoon, one in the evening, and then stream over the worldwide internet within that same evening. It's going to be a big deal. And I can't say anything more than that about it. It's all kept in silence. I'm filming all over the world as we speak right now. And so I'm hiring some extra people, including another frontline producer. Must have experience in frontline producing, because we're interviewing hundreds of people. Normally in a documentary, you'll film 10 to 20. We're filming hundreds. Also, I'm hiring a full-time nutritionist at a living wage. And then, in turn, you will counsel people for free. For those who cannot afford to go to a nutritionist, dietitian, holistic doctor, nurse, so I'm going to pay you. And as long as you are holistic, but you must have a qualified background and be certified. I'm hiring that. And I'm also hiring two people who can work in helping people in a health food store. So if you have qualifications in those areas, give a call, 646-926-5422. I'll be interviewing people over the weekend and hiring people on Sunday. Now, we have a couple big events coming up. One is next Friday. I'm going to be doing a limited person lecture. I'm doing it because I've come up with something brand new. It's as important as the work I came up with on life energies. If you recall, I classified half of our behavior as coming from the energy that we come from, dynamics, supportive, creative, etc. Well, this adds a whole new dimension to understanding every problem we have in life, from relationships to what we do, how we do it, and whether we succeed or fail in life. I'll simply call it the harmonics lecture. That's all. No more on it until then. And I will be filming, and it'll be 2 hours. It'll be from 7 to 9, and I'm allowing 50 people. That's it. I was going to do it as a fundraiser for our sister station, but they simply at this time are not able to organize it. And I've got to get it done because of my filming schedule. So it's next Friday, 7 to 9. And on the Upper West Side, if you want to come, I can only have 50 people because I can't use a microphone, meaning I cannot overmodulate. A microphone would boom the whole room. You'd hear it in the balcony, and it would destroy the quality of my voice on film, which is a quiet voice. So I can only have people who are going to sit right in the front rows. Call 646-926-5422. If that's busy, call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, if you'd like to join me for my only lecture in the New York area in the next 12 months. So next Friday, and only 50 people can come, but it's going to be a powerful, mind-blowing lecture. Once you hear what I have to say, you're going to go, damn, that just makes sense. Why didn't I think of that? It's going to be fun, and it's going to be very upbeat and very insightful. Also, I'm happy to announce that the ALBA Human Rights Documentary Film Festival, which is one of the most prestigious in the world, is having it's 2 days next Tuesday and Wednesday in Manhattan, and it's at 211 East 49th Street, and between 3rd and 2nd Avenue. My film, Poverty Inc., is closing the festival, which is a big honor, and then they have the award ceremony afterwards at 8 o'clock next Wednesday. I'm going to be there. And for those of you who have not had a chance to see Poverty Inc. and want to support all the other human rights documentaries on issues that you may have heard of but didn't know more about, this has got the best human rights documentaries in the world. This is it. It's only 2 days. And so I'm going to be there. If you want to come, call their number, 212-674-5398, 212-674-5398. It's the ALBA, A-L-B-A, Human Rights Documentary Film Festival, the 26th to 27, 28, 3 days. Mine is Wednesday night, 8 o'clock, showing, and then afterwards. So that's that. Now, in studio right now is Valerie. Valerie Van Cleve is the frontline executive producer of so many dozens of our documentaries, including Poverty Inc., including Saving the Planet One Bite at a Time, including Knocking on the Devil's Door and all those others, that, the War on Health, Death by Medicine. And we've worked together for a long time. And she's here to remind people the importance of, if you can attend a local film festival, always do, because you get to meet people from all over the world. You get exposed to information on socially relevant issues that you wouldn't otherwise know about. Whenever I can get to a film festival, I always go. I have an enormous amount of respect for the other participants, and we have great conversations, and you can join in those conversations. Valerie, our audience never has a chance to hear from you.
No, not very
You're behind
often.
The scenes every day working on the
working,
editing up
working.
There.
But I wanted to come on today and just to thank all the people and all of the many film festivals that we've been in and who have helped to make our documentary Poverty Inc. one of the most honored and recognized documentaries this year that's come out. And just to let everyone know and let you know some of the awards. We won the Special Jury Award at the prestigious World Fest Houston Festival, and that's higher than the Platinum Award, and Best Documentary Jury Award at Hoboken Independent Film Festival. Poverty Inc. went on to win Best Documentary at the Hollywood Independent Film Festival, the New York October Film Festival, the Los Angeles Film Review, and the Alaska International Film Awards. The Prestige Film Festival in California gave us the Gold Award, and Poverty Inc. was given the Awards of Excellence at both San Francisco Film Awards and the Acolyte Global Film Competition. We won the Silver Cindy Award at the International Cinema in Industry Contest, and currently we are an official selection. Poverty Inc. is an official selection at 30 other festivals.
That means we're a finalist.
Yes.
Yeah.
And hopefully we will win Best Documentary in one or two of those. And that's from all across the United States, from Malibu, South Carolina, Reno, Florida, Cincinnati, Reading, Pennsylvania, just on and on and on. And so great congratulations to you for all your tremendous work, Gary.
Well, it's not my work. Understand something. Poverty Inc. was 5 years. We filmed over 133 experts, from Greg Palast and Michael Hudson, all of the people who had something to say that the mainstream media wouldn't want to hear, but also going into the bayous, going on to the Texas dirt farms, going up into Kansas and Compton and all the other places in the United States where people are pretty invisible. You don't see them. And having them give a chance to tell their story. Because, as I said the other day, it is unfair to assume that because someone is in debt that they put themselves there automatically. Yes, some people do. Some people buy what they don't need, buy it on credit, which gives an artificial concept that we're thriving. You're not thriving if what you bought it with debt. Right? Because then you owe someone. So you bought that shirt, or you bought that meal, or bought that movie ticket. Did you pay cash for it from your savings? That's good. Did you buy it on debt, that if you miss your payment, you can pay 38 to 40%, and it's going to start at 18%? It's not good. So I wanted to show that there are people in this country who've done everything they could, playing by the rules of decency, ethics, and common sense, and they're in debt because of circumstances beyond their control. How can you say that a child that is hungry, and there are 18 million of them, that somehow they're irresponsible and cause their own hunger? You can't. Because it's not true. They didn't cause their hunger. The system did. How, if you're a single parent living in an environment and doing two jobs, but your children don't have enough to eat, and hence you're called, what, lazy or irresponsible when you haven't bought yourself a new thing in 2 years? Then you're not irresponsible. You're being as responsible as you can. So on the one hand, we have to be very careful that we don't get caught up into the radicalization of the rhetoric by blaming people for something that they had no part in, as compared to those people who do. And we have to measure each of those. So when you're out there and you see, because Val, for example, she and at one point three editors and three producers were working around the clock to get this thing done. I'd be out in the film filming, and then I send the film back, and then she takes it and she finds the best parts of it. I might end up with 3 minutes out of a hour-long documentary that one person is in. You might film for a long period of time. What we're doing now is that we're packaging that we don't use and putting it up on the internet, and that way you can see it. For example, The Wolf of Wall Street, the character that Leonardo DiCaprio played the movie. We got the last permissible film interview of him before Martin Scorsese said you can't do any more interviews. We got a 40, I think it's 42 to 46 minutes of him describing what it was like on Wall Street. And that's up there. It's free. So this morning when we Googled the search results of some of our films, War on Health had 358 million search results. And Poverty Inc. had, I think, 112 million. And yet we don't play them in theaters. We believe in going to the public. The internet is the future for everyone. And it's unfortunate when people, a lot of filmmakers, just don't understand it. If you were at these film festivals, they make the mistake of winning an award. Next thing you know, there's a producer there buying the rights, a distributor buying their rights. They think they're so happy. You know, now they're going to be all over the place. They're not going to be anywhere. My suggestion, never sell your film rights to anyone from Hollywood, because you're never going to see a nickel. You're going to be out. You're going to see your movie selling. It's just you won't be getting any royalties on it because they control all rights, and they have a way of magically accounting for everything as an expense in Hollywood. You'll never see it. Trust me. I know what I'm talking about. That's why we keep the rights, and that way we can put our films right up on the internet and show them for people all over the world, and that's what you want to do. So the newest film we're working on, and it's a massive film. It is big by any standards. And so Val will be getting the film clips. Did you get the film footage that we've...
We haven't received it yet, Denmark? But he sent it.
Just this week we filmed in Denmark.
Yeah, Copenhagen.
Copenhagen, yeah. And it's a powerful message. Wait for the people when we announce we'll do it as a fundraiser for one of the non-commercial stations. Thank you, Val.
Thank you.
And to help the people at our sister station, WBAI in New York, not just my audience, all the people, if you have not received your premium, the current one or any at all, we're making every effort to help you get them. My office is. The last time we did this, we got 68 people, their premiums, who had had trouble getting them. Contact my office receptionist, Bianca, and give her how many premiums you're owed, and the specifics. We have to make sure you actually paid the station. And then we will go about trying to get you your premiums. I have three plans that I'll discuss in depth on an upcoming program of how to save the station and how to get everyone their premium and keep that from ever happening again, that you pay money and you don't get your premium. Call 646-926-5422, and then I will go to bat and try to get your premiums. Listen to this. Think you'll enjoy it.
Dumber than ever before. The average IQ of Westerners has dropped by a staggering 14 points over the last century. We now have attention spans less than that of goldfish. Our children are also becoming stupider. Since 2006, the average SAT score has fallen 20 points. In Japan, high school students are at the same educational level as Americans who hold four-year college degrees. For 2 million years of evolution, our brains grew larger, but there's been a reversal. Our brains are now physically shrinking. The anecdotal evidence isn't that encouraging either. Take a look.
World War II. Ever hear of it?
No.
No, never heard of World War II?
No.
Who were the two teams in World War II?
George Bush versus Saddam, whatever his name is. I don't know.
How many world wars have there been?
Three.
Can you tell me what democracy is?
No.
It's crap.
What
kind of shit is that?
Name one country in Europe.
I don't know.
You don't know?
When the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence in 1776, what year did they sign the Declaration of Independence and break away from England to start America?
78. I don't know.
1978?
Yeah.
1978.
A country that starts with a U.
Utopia.
You went full retard, man. Never go full retard.
What do you think the TPP is?
TTP?
Now, what is TTP?
The DPP?
The what?
TPP.
I have no idea.
Nope.
I have no idea what that is.
I ain't got a clue.
I have no idea.
I have no idea. The toilet paper products.
I'm being totally honest. I just don't care right now.
Do you know what the TPP is?
Nope.
What's TPP?
Toilet paper?
They're coming up with new ways to screw the people. Does that surprise you?
No.
Do you care?
Not really.
Why don't you bother to know about the trade?
I just don't care.
Who's Fidel Castro?
A singer.
9999!
You guys here with the March Against Monsanto event?
Actually, no. We just kind of appeared here.
Do you know what it is?
No, we're not. We don't.
Do you know what Monsanto is?
Nope, not at all.
Have you heard about Monsanto?
No.
GMOs?
No.
You have any interest in it?
No.
I think they make carpet.
Genetically altered.
Monsanto.
Carpet?
Carpet company.
Is that what?
No, I don't
know. Monsanto makes carpet?
Sure.
I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as.
Oh, you are so dumb. You are really dumb. For real.
When the Founding Fathers signed the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776, we declared independence from England.
Yeah.
What date did they sign the Declaration of Independence?
The date? I don't know.
What date was that?
Was it 19-something? Like 1914? 1812? 1876? I don't know.
Okay. I'm a little bit mixed up with the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which one is throwing the rocks? How many sides does a triangle have?
Damn, four.
There's no sides.
Which way?
What's Osama bin Laden most infamous for?
Osama?
Yeah.
Or Obama?
Osama.
I have no idea who Osama is. Obama, you should run for a third term because we need you.
Are you here voting for Obama's third term?
Yes, of course.
Obama's third term!
What does the D.C. and Washington, D.C. stand for?
Dominican Republic.
Washington, Dominican Republic. The capital of America, what does that mean? Washington.
Washington, D.C. Washington. Obama. There you go.
Do you have a TV at home?
Yes, we do.
What does TV stand for?
Television viewing. That's all I know. TV, great TV.
Teleporting vortex.
There you go.
Teleporting vortex.
What is a mosque?
Don't have any idea.
You want to guess?
An animal.
You're a basic bitch.
Who is the vice president?
Vice president. Oh my god. I'm gonna pass.
Are you stupid or something?
Which state does KFC come from?
What, the chicken? Yeah. I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay, do you know what KFC stands for?
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
70% of Americans are overweight, and obesity just hit an all-time high. 27.7% of the US population are obese. Studies show that obese people have 8% less brain tissue than people of normal weight. The areas of the brain affected by this tissue loss relate to critical thinking and long-term memory. Obesity also hinders blood circulation around the brain. Eating fatty foods also has an immediate negative impact on short-term memory. So the fat pride movement, now being promoted by the media and the fashion industry, is not only encouraging chronic illnesses, it's institutionalizing the acceptance of stupidity. And I'm fully aware of the fact that people will accuse me and those who make these kind of videos as being cynical and snobbish, because simply drawing attention to these kind of people appears to be an exercise in futility. In a truly progressive society, Those who are most informed about things that matter should be perceived as the pinnacle of cool and trendy. But dominant mainstream culture has instead made cool.
Those are just some thoughts about one person's view of stupid, but I have encountered that when I've had a chance to spend a lot of time with people, not in gotcha interviews, but just get their views on our current political system, because we should be, as a reasonable society, seeing the failures of each and every administration to help the average person, the working person, the poor, people, minority, and those with special needs. We should see that doing more of the same will not make any difference. And yet we can't get more than 2% vote for Ralph Nader or Dennis Kucinich or Jill Stein, Rocky Anderson, Gary Johnson. None of the independents. So you have to understand that you have to look at how people come to an awareness of what they don't know. Try having a conversation with a lot of young people today. There are exceptions about the world they live in, and they can tell you a great deal about the Cardassians. They cannot tell you if France is a country, where it's at. They're clueless. Or anything about history, sociology, psychology, economics, or health. So we've left an awful lot on the table for another discussion. Let's go out now to Urbana, Illinois, and say hello to Professor James Kilgore. I gave you his background earlier today. And James recently released a comprehensive exploration of the U.S. mass incarceration apparatus, Understanding Mass Incarceration, A People's Guide to the Key Civil Rights Struggle of Our Time. His website is freedomneverrests.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Great to be here, Gary. How are you doing today?
Good. In the past, most of the programs I've hosted dealing with our prison system have focused on the privatization of our prison system and the incarceration of those convicted of crimes who are serving sentences, largely for minor crimes and misdemeanors, such as possession of marijuana. And parallel to this is local and county jail systems that don't receive as much attention as they deserve. And this huge national network of jails ends up confining about 11 million people. And a growing number of this population are women and transgender individuals. And largely, these are people who are homeless or suffer from mental problems. And the horrors of this public jailing system largely are virtually unnoticed. And they're underreported or non-reported. And understanding what is actually happening is not sufficient. It seems incumbent that we need to understand why the United States is home to 25% of the world's prison inmates, while only representing 4% of the world's population. So I'd like you to focus on the reasons why this other jail structure is growing and its relationship with the fact that national and state governments are not dealing with growing inequality and have been cutting back social and welfare services at every opportunity, and address this relationship and explain how the system of jails is a means to compensate for the failures of state and local governments to provide the necessary services and jobs and training, or encourage businesses that would hire people at a living wage and de-ghettoizing the American landscape, which they could easily do with people from that environment living there. They're not doing it. There is gridlock, there is disdain, and then their number one cheerleader in the presidential campaign right now, the one that has received the most money from this system, is Hillary Clinton. The forum is yours.
Well, thanks, Gary. I'm glad you're drawing attention to the place of jails in the criminal justice system. Most of us, when we think of mass incarceration, we think of these huge, you know, prisons, Attica, Sing Sing, Leavenworth, or whatever. But at a given moment, about a third of the population that's incarcerated is in local jails, county and city jails. But as you pointed out, over the course of a year, we have something like 11 million admissions into county jails. And most of these people are there for what I would call the result of the criminalization of poverty. And what's happened is that we have cut back on mental health facilities, on substance abuse, and I think particularly we've cut back on public housing. And instead, public housing, the primary form of public housing over the past 2.5 decades has really been the building of jails and prisons. And we are now housing people behind bars instead of in public housing, public housing projects and so forth. Not that the projects that we had in the past were wonderful, but the state was assuming some responsibility for addressing the housing issue. But what's happened is that across the country, people have adopted a tough on crime, zero tolerance, broken windows policing kind of policy, which has hit targeted neighborhoods, mainly low income, poor people of color living in these neighborhoods. They've made all kinds of new ordinances and against sleeping in public, against lying down in public, against living in cars, against loitering. In Silicon Valley, they even made a law against living in your car. And so all of this has resulted in people being locked up for these minor offenses. And in fact, we now have about 10 times as many people with mental health issues in jails and prisons as we do in mental health facilities because of the closure of those facilities in our communities. So as you're emphasizing, this is a problem of criminalizing poverty, and then as the people that are arrested, as that number grows, then there's pressure on local governments, counties in particular, to grow their prison facilities, and these become major capital expenditures in local government.
I want to follow up with a little more in-depth explanation of what you just touched on, and that would be the role prisons now serve to replace mental health facilities. And today, there, as you stated, there are more inmates with serious mental health conditions that require other kinds of professional assistance. I believe the best assistance would be holistic psychotherapy. I do not believe in drugs because studying it very deeply, I have not found that they work. But counseling does frequently. And we're not helping these people. There's no one in a prison who can counsel these people. They get guards when they act out in a way that is normal to them or the only way they know how. Then the other inmates will beat them or the guards beat them. As a result, recently, one mentally disturbed inmate in New York City was scalded to death. Now, nothing, of course, of any consequence will happen to the guards because their unions and the people around them. All over America, we're not looking honestly of who's causing all this beating and the rapes and allowing this to happen and the fights. There is no sense of what it means to be locked up for minor infraction. We shouldn't. For drugs, we shouldn't. We should let everyone out of prison. And if you want to have them serve the community in some meaningful way, then have them serve the community. Have them go in and use what skills and knowledge and talents they have within communities. But keeping them incarcerated because someone's making a profit off of it, and if not a profit in a state institution, the vendors make money. And if not the vendors themselves, the people that are then hiring these convicts at what is it, $2 a day to make different products, all kinds of products, are made for multiple industries that then get full benefit of the retail and don't have the cost. It's no different than a shirt maker and a dressmaker in Bangladesh. So every way we could possibly do everything wrong, we're doing, and we're doing absolutely nothing right, in my opinion. And especially double that when it comes to dealing with no mental patient should be in any prison in the United States. They should be under the care of mental health professionals using more natural ways of dealing with them. Your thoughts on that? Challenge me where you will.
I think that's totally correct in terms of dealing with the issue of mental health. It's mental health, and I would also argue substance abuse. These are problems that should be dealt with in terms of as health issues, not as criminal justice issues. And so I spent 6.5 years in federal and state prisons. I've seen the kind of mental health services that are provided. It's called pill line. So when you go to dinner, half the people go to the dining area and half the people head for the pharmacy, and you have this big long line of people waiting to take their pills. You have a guard or a nurse sitting there watching them to make sure they swallow the pill and they don't sell it to someone else. And what psychotherapist, psychologist of any worth would ever recommend incarceration as a way to help deal with somebody's mental illness. As you point out, we need a holistic approach to this, and that's never going to happen in prison. But I think one of the things you're pointing out is that the fact that the system has become so entrenched that it keeps regenerating itself. It's just like a business that thrives on getting more customers, expanding its client base. Only prisons don't attract people by advertising on the internet or doing late night TV ads and promising, you know, extra bonuses if people sign up. They do it through lobbying and pressuring and changing laws and doing these massive campaigns of fear so that people in communities support prison and jail building, because they're really told that this is the only way we can deal with the problem of drug dealing, the problem of immigrants, the problem of mentally ill people committing violent crimes. All of this is part of a massive fear campaign, which since the beginning of the war on drugs in the 1980s has fed into this massive urge not only to build prisons and jails, but to deal with people through the philosophy of punishment rather than thinking about how do we help people to develop, how do we build community, how do we learn to cooperate rather than to punish someone every time they make a mistake.
Clearly you should write a book, 50 Shades of Republican.
Well, I wish it was just the Republicans because, that were doing this.
Yeah, no, it's Democrat. It's Hillary would be holding one of the whips, I can assure you. They have the whole wrong attitude that the only way you can get elected or show that you're powerful is by militarization of your vocabulary, the war on poverty, the war on drugs, the war on cancer. Show me anything but medical Vietnams they've ever gotten from any of these wars. They've lost all of them, but they profit at the same time. They profit, we lose. Final question, what are your opinions on where the Democratic candidates and Obama stand on mass incarceration in the prison system now, out of control? No need to deal with Republican candidates since they would fare better being locked into asylums rather than writing prison reform. From Clinton, I only hear meaningless platitudes and rhetoric about the need to reduce mass incarceration and employ what she calls low-level punishment. Gee whiz, wonder what that low-level punishment means. You know, and yet the corporate Democrats and all those suck-ups over on MSNBC, and they're all suck-ups in my opinion, they're an embarrassment to journalism. And if we don't watch it, Pacifica, it could go the same way by being nothing more than a platform for Hillary if people really knew the true goals of some of the people out there. So tell us what is the end game of all this when it comes to, do we really want to help people or do we want to punish them for profit?
Well, I think the end game is yet to be determined. I mean, I think the end game for the politicians is basically, let's address this problem by maybe reducing the prison population by 10%, set up a reentry program here, a restorative justice project there, finished and done, a little bit of a Band-Aid, and we can say we've dealt with mass incarceration, then we move on to the next problem. I don't think that politicians on their own are going to solve this problem because they're not affected by it. But to keep the pressure on for the kinds of political change that we need a social movement that's going to keep pushing on this issue, a social movement that involves people who have been directly affected by this, who have been in prison, who've had their loved ones in prison, who've seen their communities decimated by having people captured out of their communities and put into prisons and jails. We need that kind of a social movement to keep our eye on the prize, and that is that if we are to return to the levels of incarceration of 1980 when this madness more or less began, we have to take about 80% of the current prison population out from behind bars. That would bring us to an incarceration rate about on par with the UK, which is the highest incarcerator of the countries of Western Europe. And that's, we're talking about getting the prison population down by 1.7 million people. That's not going to happen through legislative reform, through changing a few laws. That's only going to happen by a massive transformation of the thinking and a massive reallocation of resources away from corrections into the communities that have been decimated and providing the kinds of support and the kinds of social welfare programs that I think you were talking about at the beginning that really address the problems that people have, you know, rather than dealing with them by punishment.
I would add one more onto that, James. expunge from every person's record who is a non-violent drug offender and or misdemeanor, expunge their records so they do not are not limited in their job, education, or other quality of life issues because they have a record. There's no need. Those people have been to jail. That's enough. Now expunge it. The serious criminals, career criminals, yeah. You want to know who they are. But all those others, they don't deserve in jail. They deserve another chance. And there's where you could start reform groups, counseling groups in communities all over. And you know one of the largest communities you've got? The white suburban communities, because that's where most of the people who use drugs and commit these crimes are. They just have a disproportionately low number of people going to prison for those crimes compared to those of color in ghettos. So we need people to get counseled, not get a jail tag. Thank you, James.
Thank you very much, Gary. It's been good talking to you.
Professor James Kilgore, K-I-L-G-O-R-E. The book is Understanding Mass Incarceration. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program.